Welcome back to The Damage Report, everybody. It is Wednesday. I'm Johnny Rolla. J.R. Jackson is here making it again. As always on Wednesday, J.R. Rated. Welcome.
It's J.R. Wednesday.
Good luck with the crisp white shirt. We are in a fast-paced environment with a lot of coffee flying around and stuff. We'll see how that
survives. There's small cues. You can see I'm even moved this so slowly because I'm worried I'm going to get something on a white shirt. Mm-hmm. That when you really have like 6 to 7 white shirts, but you're worried about every one of them.
When he put his mug on the desk, my side of the desk went up a little bit, actually. That is a big mug. And we've also got a big show. So not only do we have gigantic news, the middle, I would say middle third of the country is a solid block of ice right now. It is kind of a disaster. We're going to have updates on that, including the president weighing in on the weather situation gripping the Midwest right now. A little bit later on the show, I want to really focus on a couple of different angles on the economic situation that we are in as a country and what is either needed to fix it or what people are interested in doing to potentially fix the economic situation with stuff like inequality, stuff like that. So new polls on socialism. How interested are different groups of Americans in socialism? There are some fascinating findings here that I would not have expected. Then on the other side, Howard Schultz. We've been mocking him constantly on this show throughout the week, but there is a network where he is getting quite a bit of praise. We will reveal how that's playing out. Also, we have two great guests. So from Hong Kong, from Time, Suyin Haynes is going to be joining us to break down how the Me Too movement has moved over and started to find some success in Asia. We're breaking that down. Later on, one of the documentarians behind the film Sharkwater Extinction will be joining us to talk about the shark trade, shark fin soup, the continuing issues with that in various parts of the world. So obviously lots to get to. Why don't we jump right into it? Right now, the situation in the Midwest is absolutely horrendous with shockingly low temperatures. To put it in perspective, I guess, we saw that with wind chill right now in, I believe, Chicago, it feels like negative 51 degrees, which without any added detail is insanity. But right now, that means it feels 100 degrees colder in Chicago than in LA. Now, any reasonable person hears that number and thinks, what is going on in our country? But we don't have a country filled with just reasonable people. We also have Donald Trump. And so he, in advance of this polar vortex that we knew was going to be absolutely devastating, would likely lead to deaths. And by the way, already has been linked to at least 6 deaths. He tweeted this: in the beautiful Midwest, wind chill temperatures are reaching minus 60 degrees, the coldest ever recorded. In coming days, expected to get even colder. People can't last outside even for minutes. What the hell is going on with global warming? Please come back fast, we need you. So he talked, like part of that tweet was, people won't even last outside. So he seemed to understand that this is a deadly threat. And he still felt like it was comic fodder for an absolutely insipid, stupid joke about global warming.
When you don't have, I guess, an adult approach to things like, you know, climate change, and when the argument is consistently based in elementary school terms, you don't know how to get out of it. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it's worked for him this long. It's the ongoing thought process for this president, or at least the way he approaches things. He continues to be allowed to get away with the stuff because he's always been that way. So he can say random, I saw that tweet when he put it out. And there's ha-ha-ha-ha-has and laughters and, oh, you got him. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. What does that mean for your agenda? What does that mean for the people who you said are going to die, who now some have, and under what circumstances that's happened? You know, in the summertime, it happens regularly where elderly folks or people without as much money, mostly elderly poor folks, don't have money for air conditioning, say like in the South. And it gets extremely hot. They're like, hey, we're going to do these donation things, maybe get some elderly folks some air conditioning so they won't die. Mm-hmm. Do we joke about that? It's a regular thing. We know it happens. But it doesn't mean suddenly, hey, because in the summertime it gets so hot in certain parts of the country that people die and we should help them. That's a solution to the problem. Instead of just joking and saying, hey, you know, some old folks are going to die this summer. Guess can't wait for that snow to come back. Yeah. What's the point?
Yeah.
Does that lead to an agenda? Is that part of a proposal you're going to push to have Congress pass a bill? What's your end game?
Yeah.
There's none.
Yeah, and one of the frustrating things too is, like, I do not expect out of Donald Trump that there's anything underlying that joke, that there never could be. But there's a lot of people who say, in effect, the same exact thing. Regular people, people in media, Fox News, you'll hear stuff like this. If there's global warming, why does my refrigerator produce ice? Those sorts of things. But the thing is, like, if you hear that Chicago is experiencing negative 60 degrees right now, and we've had a conversation for literally decades about global warming, even if you don't believe that global warming is happening, wouldn't you at least be curious enough to say, why is it that it's so cold in the center of the country right now? And try to figure out, maybe I could look into this and it'll buttress my argument against global warming. But they don't do that. Yeah. I want to be very clear. They don't do that. Because if you actually looked into this, why is it that we have these incredibly intense polar vortexes right now? Why are they more intense? Why are they happening more frequently? And the thing is, it is linked to global warming. We talked recently about Arctic temperatures being like 50 degrees higher on average than in past decades. These two things are linked. As you heat up parts of the world, you're going to shift weather patterns. You're going to shift massive air flows and things like that. That helps to contribute to polar vortices in other parts of the world. Now, you can get a scientist on if you don't want to have to do the research yourself. If you have a show, if you're Tucker Carlson or whatever, you can, like, you know, it can be real scientists, you can get Bill Nye or whatever. You get some science communicator, and they would be able to explain it to you, but they don't care enough to actually find out. And that means that their viewers, some of which are going to experience this cold, some of which might be injured, some of which might die, are going to go into it completely ignorant because the people they trust to explain the world to them aren't interested enough to actually look into it.
It stretches further than that too. This is what's hard. And it's been said a million times, the difference between climate and weather. Mm-hmm. So we'll leave it at that and try to allow them to Google those two words. So on top of that, also the governor of Kentucky, Matt Bevin, he was on a radio interview and he said, oh man, we're getting soft because kids are being kept out of school because of the extreme weather. And he said, there's no ice going with it or any snow. Why does it have to be ice or snow for it to be extremely cold? Why is that simple thought process? And he said, we're getting soft. His bottom line was, we're getting soft. Again, it's based in this emotional, hey, we're tough guys, we're Americans. Mm-hmm. So we go outside, we're still humans, by the way. I'm not sure when we became robotic. Mm-hmm. But we can't go outside in negative 55 degree weather because people literally, it's instant, near instant frostbite. Mm-hmm. After you talk about how tough you are, go out and chill and stand out in it for 15, 20 minutes. Yeah. And tell me how you feel.
Yeah, I think he's got a good point. I think that he is a tough guy. And that's why if you are around him and if you see him in public, if he's wearing a coat, I want you to raise that as a concern because Matt Bevin might be getting soft. Why are you wearing a coat? Why are you wearing shoes? Why don't you toughen up in the negative 55 degrees? That is so perfect. I'm so glad that you found that because that is like the need to own the libs and to own the millennials and all that, even at the expense of people dying. So I want to make the case that we are in a participation trophy culture and everybody's weak and wants a safe space. And if that means that a kid has to, you know, get like hypothermia, then that's what it'll take. Okay? Jesus, a safe, we want a safe space from the negative 55 degrees. That's what we want right now.
Can I give one more quote from Bevin?
Yeah.
It does concern, he said he was joking a bit with the whole thing like we've gotten soft. So this is where he's serious. It does concern me a little bit that in America, on this and many other fronts, we're sending messages to our young people that if life is hard, you can curl up in the fetal position somewhere in a warm place and just wait until it stops being hard.
It's literally
so
cold.
Life is too easy. Because, I mean, maybe previous, in the olden days, around the turn of the 20th century, we can go ahead and say, hey, you know, people died in extreme conditions because we didn't have the ability to save them. Let's go back to that?
Yeah.
Why is that what we're longing for?
The good old days. Make America die of exposure again. And look, I could make a metaphor of how in the it's going to be so difficult to deal with global climate change that many people like Matt Bevin, just want to curl up in a fetal position, not actually do anything about it, but we won't go into more details. I want to end with one thing. Let's show just a little bit of video of what's going on right now. It's so cold that for trains to operate, Take a look at what they need to do. There you can see they have set fire to the train tracks. Look, I'm going to plead ignorance. I didn't know this was a thing they did. I don't see how that's safe. I guess they need to do it, though. What world are we living in? What have
we
wrought?
You wonder what damage could be done. And also, there's certain sections that they set the fire to. So what about the other sections that aren't? It's not like a I fire line.
I guess they identify the worst ice. I honestly don't know. But I do know it's probably not a good situation, and we should probably rely on people with a more nuanced understanding of the situation we face than Donald Trump.
And our friends in Chicago and other parts of the country, you know, the North, and it's going to go to the Northeast, Midwest, and everything. Be safe. Don't listen to people that tell you you're not being tough by going outside and shoveling snow. If you have to, I hear you, but be prepared.
Yeah. Stay inside.
Yeah.
Stay warm. Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, more.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
More for you. Here at the Damage Report, we've done quite a bit of coverage on the effects of the Me Too movement inside of the US, but its effects do not actually stop at our own borders. And joining us now to help break down the international ramifications is writer for Times, Suyin Haynes, who joins us now from Hong Kong. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for staying up as late as you are to join us on the show. We really do appreciate that.
No problem.
So we, as I said in the intro, we talk a lot about the Me Too movement inside of the country, you know, from which it spawned, but it has actually spread to other parts of the world as well, correct?
Yes. Yes, that's correct. I think it's important to note that it's taken on a lot of different forms around Asia, from women in Thailand speaking out against slut shaming, from women in Japan talking about the kind of effects of the discrimination in the workplace. And in the story that I co-authored with my colleague Aria Chen at Time as well, we look at China and South Korea as two kind of examples and two case studies of how the movement has blossomed in different ways in these two countries.
And I guess I should give the caveat, I don't want to take away the agency of the activists working in these countries, that it was sort of picked up in many cases by groups, primarily women, who had been operating to try to bring progress in these areas for quite a long time, correct?
Yes, that's completely right. It's important to note that although women in Hollywood and the kind of what we know now about Harvey Weinstein, et cetera, it did inspire some women to speak out in Asia, particularly So Ji-hun in South Korea, who is one of the main characters of our story. A lot of women's activists around the region have been working for these kinds of changes for a really long time and have been waiting for this kind of opportunity to use Me Too as we know it as a kind of vehicle to advance the own causes for women in their own countries that are very specific. So it's been a kind of decades of long simmering tensions that have been present in countries like the Philippines, for example, where we've had women's rights activists working for years to kind of advance the role of women in peacemaking. Also women in India, female journalists who've been speaking out against discrimination in their newsrooms. So it's been a long-standing thing. It's not kind of a carbon copy of the Western movement as we know it.
And so thanks in no small part to the Me Too movement inside of the US, I think that we here have a far better understanding of how bad things have actually been. In countries like China or South Korea, how bad is the situation with harassment and assault and inequalities in the law and those sorts of things?
Yes, I mean, it can be pretty difficult for survivors, honestly. I think there's kind of two main things to think about here. Firstly is the kind of barrier, the challenges and the challenging environments they're operating in. So if we take South Korea, for example, Where you have a very patriarchal system, a very patriarchal society with strongly entrenched gender norms present through a lot of different facets of life, but particularly in the workplace, particularly in legal institutions, legal frameworks that make it quite difficult for survivors to get the kind of justice that they need. And to get the kind of support from law enforcement as well. And then in China, if we think about it, it's quite a different environment. Obviously, it's an authoritarian state where the freedom of the press and freedom of information is very limited. And that was what was so crucial, I think, to the kind of blossoming of Me Too in Hollywood, where the investigations by The New Yorker and The New York Times were really instrumental in showing us what we know now. That doesn't really exist in the same way in China at all. So activists kind of have to contend with censorship, state surveillance, but have done so in very inventive and imaginative ways. And that movement is largely organized online.
So I'm very glad that you brought that up, because obviously the ability to organize and protest and all that is very different. So you talked about inventive ways that they've come up with, in particular in China, to get around some of these sort of societal and governmental restrictions. What are some examples of those?
Sure, that's a great question. So some of the ways that activists that we've spoken to as part of the report have told us are using symbols to instead of words to describe what they mean. In Mandarin, right, Me Too, kind of the sounds translate to the phrase rice bunny. So using the emojis of a bunny and a rice bowl to disseminate that information, it's quite inventive. Also using quite advanced things like blockchain and that kind of technology and coding as well to get the message out there. So it's kind of, the movement is, one activist told us that it's a countless voices, nameless voices echoing each other. And I think that's really important because sometimes state censors will delete posts and I'm constantly monitoring for any mention of, you know, feminism, women's rights, harassment, Me Too. And sometimes posts will get deleted within a matter of hours. And so it's these network of volunteers that are so instrumental in reposting and sharing each other's stories and coming up with different ways to do that.
And so in some of the countries that you talked about in your piece on Time, has there been success yet in actually bringing to some form of justice high profile individuals?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, just last week, the protagonist of our article, So Ji-hun, she is a top level female prosecutor in South Korea. She had a high profile interview in January last year. Just last week, the man that she alleged she had brought her claim of harassment against, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison. But it's quite interesting to note that the terms were on, the sentencing was on the terms of abuse of power rather than like sexual harassment or sexual abuse. And that kind of brings into focus the complexities of South Korea's legal system.
Continue.
Oh, sure. Yet another example in South Korea. They've just recently launched a wide-scale investigation into abuse in sports. So the Olympic speed skating team, a wave of women spoke out about abuse they'd suffered at the hands of their coaches. So that's another really good example of how this kind of has really brought into focus the injustices that women face on a daily basis.
That's very good news to hear. And obviously, you know, there's some pushback in the US against the movement, which is unfortunate to see. It's good to see that outside of the US, there's also some progress in the right direction.
Yeah.
Soo-yeun Haynes, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Get some sleep.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, new polling on socialism. What do young Republicans actually think about it? After this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. So much more to get to with J.R. Jackson. J.R., always glad to have you here. Even if for part of the show, you're going to be booted out of the studio.
I mean, I guess I'm getting used to this by now.
You know what? You're right. You should stick around and participate in the next interview.
Actually, you know what? It's really interesting because I've heard about it's pretty devastating, the stuff that's going on with that, with the shark hunting. It's
I know. We for a couple of years had Sam Shocker around the studio. Oh, that's one of the issues she cares about and talks about quite frequently. And we've talked about it once or twice on the show as well. As we're going to describe in detail, between 100 and 150 million sharks a year are killed, which sounds like it has to be made up.
And full disclosure, John is petrified of sharks and generally doesn't want them near him or even really not to exist, but just doesn't want to see them ever. Mm-hmm. But even with that in mind, this is like horrific the way it goes. Like, I'm sure you'll find some compassion in your cold heart.
I will try. As cold as the heart of a shark, actually. So maybe that's the thing I have in common with them. Okay, so let's move on to the news. In the latest of our dispatches from the shifting of the Overton window, let's talk now about socialism. Axios and SurveyMonkey teamed up to ask the American people, that's for you, Brett, what the American people think about socialism. Now, understand there are very few people in America actually pushing for what makes sense to identify as socialism in the context of socialist states like in Europe and things like that. Generally, it's something that questions capitalism in at least some form, democratic socialism, a bunch of different things like that. There's a spectrum. But they're using the word socialism here, so just bear that in mind. So let's bring up the first chart, see what we got. This is a question, do you have a positive or negative reaction to the word socialism? And right there you have Democrats split up into different age categories. So youngest on the left, then a little bit older, and then the old folk. And you'll note that even Democrats over 65 years old, 57% of them have a positive reaction to the word socialism. And once you get down to the youngins, it's 75%. So that's huge. But that's Democrats. I mean, come on, what does that mean? They're all a bunch of crazy lefties. Let's move on now to the next one. And you're gonna see there, we should have Republicans for that same question. And so you're seeing there, okay, so Republicans over 65, only 2% have a positive reaction. Not super surprising that all of those people had to be interrupted in watching Tucker Carlson to answer that question. But Republicans, 18 to 34, 29% have a positive reaction to the word socialism. That is the amazing fact
you
of the
sound,
day.
You sound optimistic about this.
Well,
about the 18 to 24, is that the young age mm-hmm. range? You sound
18 to 34.
34, I'm sorry. You sound wildly optimistic. Why?
You're not surprised that one out of three young Republicans like socialism? Not so bad.
I'm just noticing the 70% number right under it. And that's where my, you know.
Yeah. But we don't need to turn all of them into, you know, hardcore commies or anything. But if some of them are less aggressively against it, that's going to have ripple effects.
It's going to help in elections. Because the thing is, like, it's as information is flowing more, and we're in the age of information and free information. Generally, you can get to it. Mm-hmm. People will have their own mindsets. But I wonder what percentage of that 29% of the 18 to 34, if you ask them verbally and around their peers what they think of the word socialism, mm-hmm. you're going to get a small number, because it's all about peer pressure.
That's fine. Answering a survey question is like being in the ballot box, you know, or adjacent to it.
Okay.
It's a private thing. Anyway, okay, let's go a little bit beyond that, beyond just the labels. Okay, let's talk about actual policy preferences. So what do you think is the biggest problem in this country? So let's bring this up. You're going to have four Republicans. Now, what's interesting is that unfairness in the economic system that favors the wealthy is being contrasted with overregulation of the free market interferes with growth and prosperity. Mm-hmm. So blah, blah, lib, blah, blah, conservative. Right. Young Republicans, 31% think that unfairness in the economic system is the big issue, which, okay, again, compared to libs, not a huge thing, but compared to old Republicans, it's almost three times more liberal.
I'm beginning to see where you're going with this. At least there's a shift from the old guard of Republicans to the new.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine.
I'll
go with you this on this positive tone if you
okay.
really
need
to.
Let me hit you with one more bit of data. Question, do you believe the federal government should or should not pursue policies that try to reduce the gap between wealthy and less well-off Americans? So this is not as amazing, but believe strongly that they should for young Republicans is 11%. You combine that with believe somewhat that they should, that's 39%. Again, a nice big gap over Republicans 65 and older. That means these people are not going to vote based on trying to stop AOC from becoming president or whatever, however you want to term it. I think that that is positive.
Okay, so then what this does tell us at least, mm-hmm. We're gonna stay on this positive run here. I'm gonna try really hard, which has always been the basis for say Democratic candidates, or really any candidate that wants to appeal to the majority of folks. If you want to cross the aisle, go off of real policies and how policies that actually affect Americans rather than buzzwords. Because our buzzwords are socialism. How do you identify with the word socialism versus how do you identify with this policy that actually helps Americans, that Americans all pay into? The part that and still isn't said, I mean, even from the stretches of the party, Democratic Party, that talk about democratic socialism, they still don't even go so far as to say, you're paying for this. They're still leaving that part out. They'll say, hey, you deserve it because you're Americans. And democratic socialism would work with enhancing your lives, healthcare, education, all that stuff, right? But still say, it's still not free, because that is the buzzword that's getting pushed by the 65 plus, mm-hmm. maybe the 55 plus Republicans is, hey, how about all that free stuff that they're trying to give away? No, we're paying for it. Yeah. Hey, if you make $35,000 a year, you are paying. Trust me, you are not one of these losers that's getting something for free. Your money is going into the government, trust me, mm-hmm. every day.
Yeah.
We have to let them know you're paying into the pot, because the other side is telling you that you're just a loser who's siphoning off of the rich. No, you're not. Mm-hmm. No, you're not. Build some worth into yeah. those other folks that are in the society.
Well, and especially the siphoning off the wealthy. I mean, if we go back and we look at the chart of productivity and average wages, how they begin to diverge mm-hmm. in the 80s, there is siphoning going on,
Absolutely.
But it's not from the wealthy,
Absolutely.
Really.
They've been pushing it for so long, you have to believe it almost.
Exactly, exactly. And look, this is the most recent data we have, is down to the 18-year-olds. We will have to wait to see if this continues. But if we look at generation by generation, it becoming the way it is, I think the next generation of Republicans will be centrist Democrats. And after that, everyone will be Joseph Stalin. So very exciting times coming for America in the future. But let's turn to one other bit of news. Howard Schultz is a stupid weenie who's never going to be president, but he is going to waste a lot of our time along the way. And look, in most quarters of the internet and the real world, he has been met with, at best, jokes, at worst, heckles, I guess, although he was received at least somewhat well on The View. There is a place, though, where Howard Schultz and his Don Quixote-like quest to become president has been received very well. And that is Fox News. So let's take a look at some of the things that people on Fox News and Fox Business have been saying about Howard Schultz. Stuart Varney said, if Schultz runs as independent, he splits the leftist vote in the Democrats and puts Donald Trump back in for a second term. So look, that is generally, that means that Varney's in favor of it. The idea that there's a lot of leftists that are considering voting for Howard Absolutely. Schultz seems weird. I get the general point he's trying to make, that some people will vote for him. I doubt it's like, you know, rank and file DSA members are like, yeah, Howard Schultz, I like his defense of the status quo in taxes.
He's making the same point people always make whenever there's an independent runner from either side. Maybe it's centrist right, centrist left. People get frustrated, they're going to split the vote. But you still throw in those buzzwords like mm-hmm. those leftists. It's yeah. constant branding
yeah.
with the same message.
Anyone who's not a Tea Party member is a leftist right. at this point yeah. to them. Okay, next. This is Ainsley Earhart of Fox and Friends. Wall Street would love for him to run. I know Republicans would love for him to run because he would divide the Democratic Party. So they're very focused strategically yeah. there.
It's just a basic statement. That's true.
Yeah. Lou Dobbs says, some Democrats are so concerned his bid would split anti-Trump votes on the left and ensure his reelection. Do it, Howard. Do it. Run, Howard, run. Something like that. Again, I don't, is it really splitting the anti, like, it could, it could. Look, anyone who runs as an independent, if they actually get on the ballot across the 50 states, they will get some votes. It generally, historically, doesn't pass 1, 2, 4% or whatever, but it could. Has there been a poll where he gets 1%?
Right, well.
Or 2, like, have we seen that? What is, there has been a million quotes like this over the past 3 days. There is, as far as I know, no data to back up any of it.
He's exactly what he's, I think he's gauging in these media stints he's going mm-hmm. on. It's like, let's see. He even said it when he was talking, I think it was with CNBC, at that interview. He's like, we'll go out in the country and we'll see what people think of me.
Yeah.
He's getting engaged for it.
Okay, that's fine.
To
well,
see where
Axios
the number will be.
And SurveyMonkey, please run some numbers right. and see. I think that the most common response will be, who? And then next, him? We'll see. I saw Stephen Colbert, he tweeted, he's very appealing to the people who stood in a bathroom in Starbucks and thought, the guy in charge of this should be in charge of everything. But anyway, let's see. Newt Gingrich, who's a Fox contributor. By the way, I love how if you're just a name in politics, not, like, you don't have to have anything to actually contribute, any actual insight. You get paid. You get paid by CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, and you will just always be around. That's the way it works out. Jeff Flake was just hired, I think, by CNN, is it? CBS?
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. It is CBS. Why? First of all, Jeff Flake will want to come on your air regardless, okay? Because he needs to stay relevant. You don't have to pay him. And also, what great insight is he really providing? Are you so desperate to get an anti-Trump voice that you'll bring on Jeff Flake? Bring on JR. Bring on me.
Yes.
We will say, Lots of really harsh stuff about the president.
Take that paycheck.
Exactly. And so Newt Gingrich, I don't want to, let's not put up the graphic. You don't need to actually be exposed to the direct output of his brain. But he wants Trump to encourage Howard Schultz to run. And Trump has done that. So Trump had previously tweeted, Howard Schultz doesn't have the guts to run for president. Watched him on 60 Minutes last night, and I agree with him that he is not the smartest person. Besides, America already has that. I only hope that Starbucks is still paying me their rent in Trump Tower. By the way, Donald Trump, thank you for clarifying that you are speaking metaphorically with the guts. You're not implying that he literally does not have a digestive tract. Stupid, stupid man. But anyway, look, do you think that Howard Schultz is going to last? Is he going to end up on the ballot?
I was thinking this yesterday. I don't think so. No? And I can't tell you a concrete reason why, but again, it was back to him saying he's trying to get a gauge, and there's not many positive things coming out outside of the people saying. And if you're watching this, if you're Howard Schultz and you're watching it and watching the reaction from many people on, say, Fox News, you're thinking, the only people who want me to do this are the people who have me split the Democratic vote, which maybe that's his motivation, because we saw his motivation is based in disrupting Medicare for all and also tax increases for the wealthy.
Exactly.
That's his agenda, and that would help. That's a Republican mindset. And he's like, well, look, I'm okay with helping that stick around. That's what I want.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like if you actually want him to split the vote, you need to be quieter about it on Fox News. Yeah. Like, you're really giving up the game. Yeah. And anyway, I'm honestly not that worried. Just have the guy talk more about taxes, and he will write himself off into irrelevancy from my point of view. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We're going to kick JR temporarily out of the studio, although he will be back later. Another interview coming up on the other side of this break. As we continue on our busy lives out there across vast swaths of the Earth's surface, the situation for sharks is absolutely horrendous. It's something we've talked about before on the Damage Report. An upcoming documentary, Sharkwater Extinction, makes clear how bad the situation actually is. The tragedy, the situation facing sharks, and a tragedy in the actual filming of the documentary as well. And joining us now to help talk about that documentary is cinematic activist Brock Cahill. Brock, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
Glad to have you here. I was able to watch the documentary. I was just awestruck by some of the numbers that are thrown around in the number of sharks that are killed every year, the trade in shark fins that continues to this day. So I want to get into all of that. I want people to understand the numbers. But in terms of your involvement in this documentary, your relationship with the creator of the documentary, can you walk us through how that actually developed?
Sure. Well, Rob Stewart was a great friend and dear friend of mine for many, many years. And when he first released his film Sharkwater, it's over 10 years ago now, about 11 or 12 years ago, I saw it and I was completely moved by the situation. And like you, shocked by the numbers and by the things that were happening out in the world. And I said, I got to get involved in this situation and help out. So out of the blue, I kind of cold called him. And I was like, hey, dude.
Really?
Yeah, I live in LA. I'm a yoga teacher. Is there anything a guy like me can do to help you? And he's like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, what are your passions? What are you involved in? I was like, I like sharks a lot. I swim in the ocean regularly. So if I can help in any way, it would be great. And he's like, yeah, teach me yoga. Mm-hmm. And so I started teaching him yoga. And he eventually moved to Los Angeles. We swam with sharks for the last 10 years together.
Yeah.
And in that process, you know, of course, we've done our best to throw our hats into the ring to enlighten the public to the challenges that are facing them and try to help them overcome some of these obstacles.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in this topic, there's a lot of ignorance. I include myself in the group that is largely ignorant of a lot of this, partially that I know in the documentary, Rob talks about wanting to change the public perception of sharks.
Yeah.
That they are not the killing machines that they're portrayed as in movies. But I'm aware of that, and I'm still scared of them. Sure. I know that the numbers don't bear it out. When the actual numbers that should scare us are the numbers that are cited in the film, 100 to 150 million sharks killed, that is considered a conservative estimate.
Yes.
It sounds insane. I don't know how that's actually possible. But also in the documentary, the crew goes to the site of a seizure of shark fins.
Yes.
These massive bags. What was it like to be exposed to how large this trade is, the scale it operates on?
I mean, it's mind-blowing, like you say, to see these kind of numbers and then to see it play out on the floor of, you know, a place in Panama or in Costa Rica or in Cabo Verde, all the locations that you see in the film. Mm-hmm. It just is, it's shocking, you know, and you can't get over the fact that this amount of biomass is being taken out of the ocean of the most important apex predator that we have on the planet. Because, you know, love them or hate them, we all need sharks. They are a keystone species that are necessary for the rest of the species on this planet to survive.
Yeah.
They control the ecosystem of the ocean, which gives us well over 70% of the oxygen that we breathe. So, you know, even if, you know, you're freaked out by sharks because Jaws came along and changed everybody's perception of what these fish were doing, you know, we have to have them. That's just that. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, and certainly if they are being wiped out, how can we allow that to go on without us even acknowledging that it's happening?
We can't.
On the scale that it is.
Yeah, and people like you and people like Rob and people like myself will step forward and say, listen, folks, this is not the case.
Yeah.
You've been fed a line of BS, and now we have to make sure that you recognize what the truth is.
Yeah.
And we feel like if people know the truth, that they'll make better decisions and they'll stand up. And there's a lot of people that are actually loving sharks these days. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll see love for sharks all over social media, and now they're starting to be respected in films a little bit more so. And and I think that's due in large part to Rob Stewart and his efforts.
Yeah, and let's talk about those efforts too, because one of the sort of constant themes throughout the documentary, at least the first two-thirds of the documentary, is that doing this sort of work where they're going to these different countries, they're investigating the trade, is not a safe thing that you can just do. They're sending drones into areas because they can't go there. There's worries about being shot. What was it like for the team to operate never knowing what sort of personal danger that they could face simply by shedding light on this?
Yeah, it was, I mean, it's freaky to tell you the absolute truth. You know, you walk into a hotel, and we're staying at a hotel that's owned by the people that run the shark fin mafia. And so they have our passports at the desk, and you never know what's going to happen. You just don't. People disappear over kind of things like this. But we always had these conversations, Rob and I, over the course of a decade of like, well, it's dangerous, but it doesn't mean we're not going to do it. We have to put our best foot forward, and this is what we care about. So, you know, whether or not it treads a line of like, uh-oh, well, we're going to go anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it's challenging, but it's something that we believe wholeheartedly in.
Yeah, and I think that the activists both that you see on screen and those, you know, not as part of the team deserve a ton of credit. That there's one member of the team who has to flee with fear over death threats. There's one of your sources is saying he can't identify a businessman because he's concerned about being killed over it.
Yeah.
So just an amazing amount, not just the natural sort of consequences are stark and crazy, but the sort of organized crime element of it is something that I had not been familiar with.
Yeah.
But one other aspect of the movie that we have to talk about is that obviously there was a tragedy during the filming and creation of the documentary, and that was the death of Rob, tragically, a couple of years ago. Could you talk about the experience of that happening, and then also how the project developed afterward?
Sure. It's actually 2 years ago to the day. This was the day that we were going out in Florida, and his passing is tomorrow. It's, that's the anniversary, and we're releasing the film on his second anniversary to celebrate his life and all of his efforts. And of course, it's wrought with emotion, as you can imagine, and losing a hero and a best friend and a son and a brother and on all the things that Rob was to all of these people that will be here tomorrow for this celebration.
Yeah.
So in that process, it was excruciating, you know, to lose someone with that much light and that much positivity that works so hard for these animals that don't have a voice. And that's just on a personal level. But then, you know, on a professional level, trying to pull the project together after we lose our hero and our narrator and everything else, and not being, you know, complete with the film. I'd say we were halfway done, probably, maybe a little bit further than halfway done. Mm-hmm. It was really challenging to pull it together by the bootstraps and get it finished. But with an amazing team and his family, his parents, Brian and Sandy Stewart, that stepped forward, we were able to go back through the library and the archives and have Rob narrate the entire film.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful, beautiful final message, if you will, and a beautiful legacy for him to leave. And whilst the film is, of course, hard-hitting on all the issues that are surrounding sharks, I believe it's also a really beautiful tribute to a good human being.
Yeah, and a continuation of the message that he relayed, not just in the film, but in many of his speeches and writing and all of that, that that he believes that everyone has the ability to be a hero about topics that they're passionate about. I mean, he talks about that in his narration. There's sections where he talks about not being scared of his own death that are both haunting but also inspirational, that he was pursuing at constant risk, not just during the dives, but even as we were saying, on the on-land portions.
Yes.
But not being scared off from doing what he felt like he needed to do. So in the end, it's obviously a tragic story, but it's an incredibly inspirational story as well.
It is. You know, yeah. I can't think of a more romantic or heroic story than somebody that gives everything that they have and that they are for what they believe in. And he paid the ultimate sacrifice, to be honest with you. You know, he gave everything that was him to this cause, and he was willing to put it all on the line for it. And, you know, there's not that many people that are willing to do such things, that are willing to put themselves at extreme risk to make sure that we have an opportunity to save these animals and to better humanity. And he, like you said, he believed that there's ways to do this, to lift up, to be a hero for what you believe in. And he's a prime example of it, you know. And as you say, people ask me all the time, is it really dangerous swimming with sharks? And like you say, the most dangerous part of our job is usually when we're on land somewhere in a sketchy situation. Getting in the water with sharks is the fun part and the payoff.
Yeah, well, so I can't guarantee I ever will, but this movie has brought me closer to it.
Nice.
And it is certainly a fitting tribute to his life and to his work. As you said, it's going to be available digital and on demand in the US February 1st, which is like immediately when you're watching this online, and Canada February 5th. I also want to say, I always hope that people can leave these sorts of things with something they can do about it. So there's also sharkwater.com.
Yes.
I know that you have suggestions for not just how people can educate themselves, but what they can do to help correct the situation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're diving into the realm of shark not just being used for shark fin soup, but what else is happening with these shark products. And we're finding that it's ending up in fertilizer and pet food and cosmetics and even food for human consumption, which is not safe at all. It's really high in, you know, pollution, chemical waste, neurotoxins, and all kinds of different things. But it's being mislabeled and fed to us as rock salmon, flake, fish and chips.
All incredibly deceptive.
Incredibly deceptive. As you know, that's a hot topic. Mislabeling food in you know, the States and worldwide is a massive conundrum. So we're doing our best to uncover this, and people can find out more on the website.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll watch the film. So Sharkwater Extinction, as well as, by the way, you should look up the past documentaries, including Sharkwater.
Yeah, and Rob's second film is called Revolution, and it deals with the state of the environment and what's going on and how we can change, you know, our processes and our patterns to hopefully make a better impact.
Well, Brock, thank you so much for joining us, helping shed light on the situation. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having
me. Good luck with the film.
Appreciate it, dude.
We're going to take a short break. We come back. One more story for you after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. We have like 10 seconds left, but we're going to use it well. At the Davos summit, you have a bunch of billionaires getting together, making themselves feel better about the current economic havoc that they're wreaking across the country. But there's some good spots. We're going to try to highlight a few this week. The first is Dutch historian Rutger Bregman, who brought up, I think, very succinctly, very accurately, what should be talked about. Here he is.
I hear people talk in the language of participation and justice and equality and transparency. But then, I mean, almost no one raises the real issue of tax avoidance, right? And of the rich just not paying their fair share. I mean, it feels like I'm at a firefighters conference and no one's allowed to speak about water, right? there was only one panel, actually.
Well, we've had two. You're the second of our panelists.
There was only one panel.
Let's go there.
One panel hidden away in the media center that was actually about tax avoidance. Yeah. I was one of the 15 participants. So something needs to change here.
So Rutger did a great job at the only time he's going to be allowed to appear in Davos. He's probably not going to be invited back. But we'll have a little bit more. But
we'll also say, I mean, look at that guy and his accent. It just sounds so un-American. I'm not lying to you. This sounds like I'm.
He's Dutch.
No way. No, it's exactly. They're going to say, oh yeah, that weird European accent guy. He has nothing to do with America. What a backwards way of thinking. It's just the way we approach things. That's why we have the superiority complex as Americans and say we're the best at all this, but we're not. Mm-hmm. And then we hear someone with a different accent, we say, oh yeah, of course, that guy's loony. You hear that accent? It's such a base approach to things. So no, he's not going to be able to convince anyone, at least not no one from our point of view.
I find it convincing. Here's a little bit more of what he said.
10 years ago, the World Economic Forum asked the question, what must industry do to prevent a broad social backlash? The answer is very simple. Just stop talking about philanthropy. and start talking about taxes. Mm-hmm. Taxes, taxes. We need to, mm-hmm. I mean, just 2 days ago, there was a billionaire in here, what's his name, Michael Dell. And he asked the question like, name me one country where a top marginal tax rate of 70% has actually worked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a historian. The United States, that's where it has actually worked. In the 1950s, during Republican President Eisenhower, you know, the war veteran, the top marginal tax rate in the US was 91% mm-hmm. for people like Michael Dell. You know, the top estate tax for people like Michael Dell was more than 70%. I mean, this is not rocket science. Mm-hmm.
That is amazing. It's much of what we and others have been saying here, but to hear it there at the actual forum, that is what needs to happen. So great job there by Rutger Bregman. There were a few other people on the panel that raised some good points. We will highlight them a little bit later on, but this is what needs to happen. This is a conversation that needs to happen. Thank you for being a part of our conversation.
Hey, good times.
Good to have you here.
Excellent.
Thank you everybody for watching. We'll be back. We still got two more shows for you. Let's see what craziness happens. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.